on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. We sure do appreciate you being with us. I hope your world is fantastic and your business is going well. As always, if you need to get in touch with us and want to talk about your business, please do so. We are more than anxious and excited to help you grow your business, do anything that we can to, you know, help you out. So anyway, very excited for our show today. First up, we have Jeremy Gottschalk. He is a marketplace safety expert. You know, when you go and buy stuff on Amazon or eBay or my site or any of the personal sites that we have all built, you have an incredible risk. And he figured out, he's been a lawyer for 20 years, how to replace that risk with certainty. And the company he runs is called Marketplace Risk. He has a new book out called Bulletproof Your Marketplace. And we're going to talk about that. Why is it so risky? How are the problems appearing? And the reason that we don't see problems is because his company is at the back end making it all work and providing the back-end infrastructure to make us safe. We should all thank him. So anyway, great information from him, and I'm excited to learn how he got the idea, how he got started, and how he got so successful. And then after that, we're doing another greatest hits. You may learn or may have heard that we lost one of our server companies and have to replace all of the files that were up there. We have Sean Heine with us of SignalWire, an incredible internet company, and he shares all of his information. So I'm excited to bring him onto the show. We haven't had him in a while. We need to invite him back. Anyway, thank you so much for being with us. We'll get started in just a second. Oh, and remember, go buy the book Real Environmentalist, please. We need to get the sales up before the launch date at the end of the month. It's already number one in one of its categories. So we've already got a number one seller. It's not even come out yet for 27 days. Thanks for being with us. We'll get started in just a second.
That's a great question.
It's great question.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Okay, that's a great question. And
yeah, it's a great question.
Those are two great examples. Great, Jim.
Jim, I think that's absolutely perfect. That is exactly it.
School for Startups Radio.
Welcome back to the show. And again, thank you so much for being with us. I'm very excited to introduce my first guest today. His name is Jeremy Gottschalk. He is a marketplace expert. He is the founder and CEO of Marketplace Risk and has built a really successful business defending marketplaces. And we'll have him explain exactly what that means. He has a best-selling book called Bulletproof Your Marketplace, Strategies for Protecting Your Digital Platform. Jeremy, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me.
All right. Stupid question. Marketplace. We're talking online stores, right? Or am I wrong?
You're right. I would say three quarters of the work that I do applies to e-commerce generally, but we're talking about, when we talk about marketplaces and digital platforms, we're talking about online stores for goods or services, essentially.
Okay. What is the problem there? I didn't know that there was a problem with my checkout buying my bamboo from the bamboo store.
Well, the good news is there shouldn't be any problems. The bad news is most founders and leadership teams don't understand kind of the legal strategies that exist that protect the specific business model. And so that's where I come in and my company comes in, is to really try and educate founders and leadership teams on kind of risk mitigation, risk management strategies, legal strategies, compliance with regulations, et cetera. Really quickly, not to go too deep, but the business model is essentially free from legal liability, according to a 1996 law that you probably have heard of called the Communications Decency Act. Within that federal law, there's a Section 230 defense, as it's called, that basically says that, interactive computer services, websites, mobile apps, are not liable for what happens between their users. It's super unique protection for essentially an entire industry that almost doesn't exist in almost any other industry. And then apart from that, you, of course, most people are familiar with terms of use, terms and conditions that essentially function as a way to limit your liability down to zero if you want. So the combination of both of those things leaves this business model essentially free from legal liability. Unfortunately, you can mess those things up and create liability, or not pay attention to them and not take advantage of them.
All right, you say free from legal liability. That's you slip on my doorstep and break your leg. I'm legally liable because I didn't clean my stoop. I don't Correct. Understand how, what's the concern? Free from legal, what could my website do?
Sure. So think of a dating context, right? Two people date and one steals the other's purse or wallet. A lot of times, instead of suing the person that they were on a date with, they will sue the platform. Or, you let your imagination go wild, right? Physical, sexual abuse, something like that. They often will sue the platform. And under the CDA Section 230, the platform isn't liable for what happened between those users. But often the platforms get caught up in the litigation because they have the deep pockets. So, if you think of, the social media companies, really anything that can happen online, offline, between users, if you think about services, so you bring somebody in your home to clean your home, watch your kid, walk your dog, any number of things could happen. They could let the dog loose. They could injure your child. They could steal something from your home. You sell goods through Amazon or through a secondhand marketplace. It could be, fake. They could be just total rubbish or garbage. You don't get what you paid for, et cetera. The bottom line is that in all of those circumstances, the platform itself is protected from legal liability, meaning if they get sued in any of those contexts, they should, under that law, be able to be dismissed from the lawsuit.
Okay. I get it. That makes total sense. It seems like I just don't see where you're making money, where there's enough problem for you to make money, Jeremy. You just told me I don't need anything. I'm protected by this law.
Sure. So you're protected by the law as long as you can comply with it. And so the crux of the Communications Decency Act Section 230 defense is that you as the platform, the language is interactive computer service, but you as the platform are not the author of the content, right? So if let's use a dating context, two people go on a date together. They create their own profiles. They communicate messages between each other. In that case, the users are the authors of all of that content, the user-generated content, and the platform is not liable. But let's say the platform starts matching you with specific dating love interests, et cetera, and they say, hey, we found a perfect match for you. They're great citizens, they're blah, 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 you're going to get married, da, da, da. Right? Now, the platform is now interjecting themselves in that, and they are now responsible for creating the match potentially for all of the content that they themselves authored. And so that's where the kind of the issue lies, and what a lot of founders and leadership teams may not be aware. If you leave your users to kind of their own devices and you let them communicate with one another, create their own profiles, you don't intervene at all, you can take full advantage of the Section 230. But when you intervene, and we're seeing a lot more of this with AI, particularly AI generating content, communications, et cetera, you potentially cannot take advantage of Section 230 because you are now the author of some of that content as the platform. And the issue is that, you know, it's an old law, unless you've run across it, unless you've litigated it, unless you're kind of really in the weeds, you probably aren't aware of it. That's the issue is not that you have to be aware of it to take advantage of it. Obviously in litigation context, your lawyers are going to know about it, but, when you're designing your product, the technology, the kind of the UI, UX, there are some things that you need to take into consideration, and that's kind of where we come in, and we will look at the product, we'll consult on the design, UI, UX, all of that.
Okay. I love your dating analogy. That keeps hitting home for me because those analogies really work well. So keep using those. All right. So I am a dating site. Let's keep going with it. I've just opened up a dating site for people that like parrots only. Okay. Mm-hmm. I come and hire you to protect my site. What are the major concerns you're going to have other than the parrot? Let's leave the parrot part out. That could get really crazy.
It could. So the first thing I'm going to do is look at how the product is designed and the user experience. And I'm going to make sure that you're not interfering with any of the communications, creating any content. So that's number one. You want to make sure that you have the full CDA 230 protection. The second is I'm going to look at your terms of use, make sure that they're enforceable both in form and substance, right? So a lot of times back in the day, we'll start here, back in the early days of the internet, you had a terms of use, in the footer, and it said by browsing or using the site, you agree to the terms of use. That's really not as enforceable, if at all, anymore. Right. You need your users to manifest their assent is the key words, which basically means take an action to show that they had notice of the terms and that they agreed to them. So that's like the form. The substance is you want to make sure that the terms within your terms of use or the provisions are also enforceable. And so there's a lot of different state laws about limitations of liability and how much you can actually limit. And then there's arbitration and litigation. There's all these different kind of nuances for what you would expect to see in those terms. And so I want to make sure that both they make sense from this specific platform's perspective, but also that they comply with all relevant laws, et cetera. From there, really, it's just making sure that you're not over-promising, kind of an under-delivering. You know, from a marketing perspective, the goal is to acquire customers, right? You need to bring people in the door. And a lot of times, very aggressive with how they describe the platform, what it can do, the features and the functionality. And sometimes it gets a little aggressive, but something goes wrong and you're going to be held to that language. So a lot of times I'll look at the language and kind of figure out, is this really, is this accurate? Is this kind of honest? Can you stand behind this? Is it transparent enough? And so those are kind of the three things that I would look at right off the bat when I'm looking at this, kind of this dating site for parrots. And then of course, with any platform, there's going to be very unique risks. With dating sites, you're looking, keeping sex offenders off. Criminals of certain degrees, certain convictions, things like that. So there's a lot of other kind of what we'll call trust and safety considerations that we'll want to look into depending on the type of platform or dating site.
All right. Is this ever for physical products?
Yes.
Okay. Walk us through that scenario now.
So 2/3 of Amazon's revenue, just so everyone's aware, is from their marketplace, which means there is a seller on one side. Amazon is in the middle, basically processing the transaction. And then there's a buyer on the other side. Of their, hundreds of billions, their 2/3 of that is attributed to their marketplace. They call them third party sellers, but Amazon does not take control of any of those goods, that they're not in their inventory. They literally process the transaction. It goes to the seller. The seller then mails it directly. And so you have, of course, different issues with the sale of goods, illicit goods. You've got, you know, goods that may be recalled that are dangerous, that are fake, you know, et cetera. Not to say that that's on Amazon, but those are some of the big risks when you're selling, when you've got a goods platform, because you don't have any control over the actual goods themselves, because they never come into your control.
Right. How did you get started with this, Jeremy? Tell us your personal entrepreneurial history, including where'd you get the idea for this? How'd you get started? Who was the first customer? All that.
Sure. So I've been practicing law, sadly, for 21 years. I call myself a recovering lawyer, for those who have been to the meetings.
I'm not sure that that's ever possible, but keep going.
Exactly. I was practicing in a big law firm, spent most of my year, law firm years at Cain L. Gates, was recruited into a client that focused on senior care and child care. It was a marketplace essentially for care providers, initially in-home care services, dog walkers, cleaners, et cetera, but they landed on child care. I was with the company for 7 years, and working with, or, you know, a marketplace focusing on vulnerable populations, we had perhaps one of the riskiest types of platforms to protect both the company and the community. And so I worked with our VCs, portfolio companies, and other childcare platforms. There were kind of tutors, nannies, babysitters, coaches, you name it. And we all got together, founders, lawyers, executives, and just talked about kind of the risk, the exposures, how each one of us was tackling these issues, and how we were protecting our users and our community. It grew organically, super productive, super useful working group, but it grew pretty quickly to the point that it started being an issue of kind of diminished returns, too many people. And then we started having a bunch of the other verticals, pet care, rideshare, you name it, that wanted in. So we launched a conference in 2015, super successful. It was a free event. It was just for kind of invite only, but it was just for operators, founders, and leaders of these platforms. That we did a second one in 2015, and then kind of one each year after that. Fast forward a couple of years, the president of Lloyd's of London attended our conference in San Francisco, invited us to host the same conference at their headquarters in London. And then from there, we added New York City, Austin, and then this year we're going to add Sao Paulo, Brazil. So I left in 2017 to focus on this full time. Ended up joining the board of the former company until we sold it to a public company a couple of years ago, which I still consult with them. But I started focusing kind of exclusively on creating content, but also leveraging my network and the ecosystem to create content for the benefit of kind of the industry and the ecosystem. So 95% of what we do is what we call peer-led. So it's not original content from us. Rather, we work with our advisory board and our community to develop content for conferences, for virtual events, for blogs, podcasts, kind of you name it. And the idea is really to hit on all of the kind of the major struggles of the day. Obviously, AI is one of the big ones now. But I just kind of put my head down and started following the need, because there were really nobody else was doing this. And, e-commerce is one of the fastest growing sectors in the economy today, and more so than retail, right? And so you've got all of this VC money, you've got consumers spending like crazy on these different e-commerce websites and mobile apps. And there just aren't resources out there for these founders and leadership teams to understand the risks. And more importantly, not only understand them, but to mitigate them. Because as I mentioned in the beginning, this business model is quite unique in that there you've got federal law, you've got contractual law that can help you to protect you, to really limit your exposure to about zero. The problem is kind of spreading the message. And so that's how we use our conferences. And then that's what led to the book, is really to kind of get that message out there and to scale it and go as kind of distribute as far and wide as we can.
Great story. I love it. Do you happen to know what my first business was, Jeremy?
I don't.
We were the world's largest summer camp company.
Oh, wow.
89 locations around the country. And when you started talking about your sitter business, I was reminded of that business I used to run. Boy, was that a legal nightmare possibility every day. We had our number one goal was, and I want to get your particular expertise, your expert judgment on this, if our standard was okay. Our standard was to get most of the kids home alive every day.
You know what? Here's the crazy thing about dealing with vulnerable populations, right? They're not, I don't want to say, you know, kind of adult, grown adults who can speak for themselves, defend themselves, advocate for themselves. And so it's definitely a unique business. And kind of like you, it's never going to be perfect, but you do your best. And you know, the unfortunate thing is, you dealing with vulnerable populations, it's like you kind of are, it keeps you up at night, right? And I'm sure you've had many sleepless nights and through no fault of your own, because when bad things happen, most often they're mistakes or they're accidents, but it's kind of on your watch. And so that's what I think ended up keeping me up so much when I was in house.
Yes, I used to stare at the 800 number at night waiting for it to ring.
I believe it.
And you know what, Jeremy, our biggest nightmare was first menstrual cycle. And
oh, wow.
Having to deal with that, you know, because the girl's away from home and mm-hmm. the most intimate thing ever happens to her. And so, boy, writing the policy for that one was hard.
I can imagine. I can absolutely imagine.
All right. What greater other legal issues do you see? How is the AI and all of the legal ramifications going to shake out? You know, I asked AI, GPT, I asked it a question about a particular video, and it came back in 30 seconds with the answer. And it was a 19-minute video. And I told my friend that, and the friend said, well, it sounds like that GPT has already scanned all of the videos on YouTube mm-hmm. and knows the video that you were talking about already, or mm-hmm. did it really watch the entire video in 19 seconds? You know, how does all this end up playing out?
Really, really, really good question. And I guess the best way to answer that is it's job security for me. In reality, yes,
I see that too.
Yeah, because we just don't know. I mean, I'll give you a couple examples, right? There's been the U.S. Copyright Office has issued various opinions on the copyrightability of the Gen AI or the Chat GPT output, right? And so far, they're saying there's no copyright in something that's produced by the machine, because ultimately it has to be a human being. So you've got kind of intellectual property issues that are still unresolved. What happens when ChatGPT essentially defames somebody, right? And so there was a recent case against OpenAI for ChatGPT. I don't remember the exact circumstances, but essentially said that an individual, I think, had been arrested and convicted of something that had never happened, right? And he sued them and he lost. And so this is happening real time.
He lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. OpenAI was not liable. But that's one court decision, right? And you've got, depending on the district court, we're going to get a split, I'm sure, on cases like that. But then the other thing, and where I focus the most of my attention is, you know, the basis of the Communications Decency Act Section 230 is that the reason the platform is not liable is because the platform did not author the content. The users did. And the users are liable, not the platform. But what happens when you integrate these Gen AI tools like ChatGPT to help you communicate faster? Or create profiles or message one another, you know, right? Then that's not, the user's not generating that. The platform's not generating that, but the platform integrated that tool that generated that. So does the platform still have this magic protection under CDA 230, which we don't know the answer to that. So anywhere that there is kind of a generative AI tool, there's going to be a huge question mark over the liability, the exposure, kind of the impact of whatever regulations or precedents on that decision, because there's this you know, there's just kind of this new analysis that has to happen. And it's so new, it's truly playing out real time. And so, that, you know, that's why I say job security, because you can't, no one's going to give you a definite answer. And if they do, they're lying to most of these kind of AI related questions.
Very true. What kind of laws do you think we should implement around AI?
Well, you know, the first 20 years of the internet went largely unregulated. And the result of that was, you know, we've had all this like fraud and these horrible online harms, sextortion, pig butchering. I don't know if you've ever covered any of those, but we've got a real epidemic when it comes to online scams, fraud, and particularly as it relates to our youth. And so the unfortunate thing is, without any regulations, kind of the horse left the barn well before, you know, government regulators kind of stepped in. The good news is, without regulation, the internet was allowed to become what it is today. And so you fast forward and the pendulum has swung the other direction, and you've got almost all states trying to regulate AI, which, if you think about it, you know, AI is technology. Technology has no borders. The internet has no borders. And so how that works, we don't know. We've got the federal government at first saying, you know, no AI statutes or laws being passed for 10 years, and they backed off that. So, you know, if it goes unregulated, I think we're going to have a period of kind of this extreme kind of technological evolution, great opportunity, it's innovation, et cetera. I think, though, that if we are going to regulate, it really has to be more focused on the downside. You think about, you know, AI-generated pornography, deep fakes, synthetic, you know, images and videos. You've got, you know, people creating, like, you know, child pornography from AI, and you know, how is that regulated? Because most of the laws today don't cover computer-generated images or videos. And so, you know, if I were to start one place, I would start there with kind of the imagery, the videos, particularly around children, then into, you know, pornography, all of that, to just regulate kind of the real extreme downside. And then, you know, get into some of the kind of various nefarious uses of AI, the synthetic images. And I don't know if you've ever talked about this on your show, but, you know, I can clone your voice in about 6 seconds. I need like 5 to 10 words, and I can clone your voice. And then I can call your sibling and say, hey, I need you to wire me $10,000. I'm in a pinch. Here's my account number. And they're probably going to do it because it sounds just like you. And I've probably masked my phone number to look like yours. And so there are some real issues that I think we need to deal with before we deal with, you know, who's allowed to create tools and databases, and who owns the information and all of that.
Great analogy. Jeremy, deep, deep, deep puddle that we are in right now. And I appreciate that you're going to be there to get us out of it.
I'm putting my galoshes on.
Yeah, it's scary, all of the issues that need to be dealt with. And it is like the old Wild Wild West still. How do we find out more about you? Get in touch. All of that, please.
Sure. MarketplaceRisk.com is where you'll find information about our online content, conferences. You can find Bulletproof Your Marketplace on Amazon.com. And then if you want to learn more about me, it's JeremyGottschalk.com, JeremyGottschalk.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you, sir.
And we will be right back.
No action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now, because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We return and sure to appreciate you being with us. Very excited to introduce you to my first guest today. I have a feeling that he's going to be a huge superstar, rock star, entrepreneur guy really soon. And we're all going to be seeing movies about him and stuff like that. The things he's doing are just amazing. His name is Sean Heine, and his company is called Signal Wire. He has had two successes before this that I could find that have been amazingly impressive in terms of creativity, exit, all of the stuff that we measure on. He built one company called Periscan and eventually sold it, and then was in charge of new products for Barracuda. I remember them, and eventually he was part of the team that took the company public. Now at Signal Wire, he is the founder and COO, and they are the world's largest telecom platform. Now, I don't know what that little phrase means, so that's what we're going to ask him first. He has customers for some of the biggest names out there like Amazon and Netflix, but he also competes with them as well. They have a product that we'll ask about that looks like that it'd be perfect for all of our consumer applications. Sean, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. That was quite an introduction.
Well, I just feel like your company, I should know it, but don't. If your customers are people like Amazon and places like that, I feel like you should already be famous.
Yeah, we're kind of, we've been around kind of as an arms dealer. So we've kind of made the tech that all these other folks use for their multi-billion dollar products. And we've been the folks behind the curtain. And, over the last 3 years, we decided, hey, the next version of our tech, we're not going to give it away to everyone else, and we're going to reserve it for ourselves. And that's what SignalWire is. It's kind of a next generation of the tech that everyone else in the world is using. And it's available as a service, and it's focused on enterprises and businesses.
Okay. So let's back up. So what do you do for Amazon, Netflix, Ring, people like that? I'm so stupid. I don't understand. Again, that phrase, the world's largest telecom platform, I don't know what that means. I feel kind of stupid,
yeah.
Sean.
Yeah, well, don't feel stupid. Even technical folks often don't understand the way telecommunication works in the world. It's kind of a niche technology.
Explain.
And information technology and telecommunications have kind of been different sciences historically. Like the phone guy and the IT guy was kind of a different role in the company, and that's converging. As technology progresses, it's all kind of information and packets instead of copper wires and electrical signals.
Right.
And so SignalWire is kind of built with that concept in mind, anticipating the future evolution of telecommunications. We're building the infrastructure that would be kind of the modern version of AT&T running the copper wires to your house back when it was American Telephone and Telegraph.
All right.
Kind of.
So you're not the people putting stuff up on telephone wires in my neighborhood.
No, that's the old way. The new way is putting software and algorithms up on servers in the cloud.
All right. Then how does it get to my business location?
Through the internet.
Okay.
So you probably heard the terminology voice over IP.
Yeah,
you know, sure. That's the concept.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Yeah, the technology that's the concept of turning a voice conversation into packets and putting it over, the internet or the network. Voice over IP is one small piece of the platform that we build. So, we do a lot with video and messaging and real-time audio. This could be a very technical. I hate to get super technical for your audience, but we're kind of like the new version of AT&T. And we work with companies that make telecommunication products to provide technology that they can use for their customers. And we also, since COVID, are packaging, fully usable applications that are a virtual office alternative and an online events collaboration platform. Very video-centric because we have some of the best video technology in the world.
Right. So that's what I see online when I go to SignalWire right now, right?
Right. You'll see mostly promotion.
Collaboration is here.
Right. And a little story about that is, SignalWire, we're a Silicon Valley company. We're funded by Sand Hill Road, Silicon Valley. So we're about as Silicon Valley as we get. Our investors include Jerry Yang, the founder of Yahoo, Samsung Corporation. We were started since inception as a fully distributed company. So that's, we have employees across the world. And what going into the office means for them is logging into a web browser and signing into a formerly internal product we call SignalWire Work. And then they sign into always on video. And so they sit in rooms just like you would in a normal office, but the video's on, the audio's on. There's privacy controls if you want to mute your video or whatever, or show that you're away. But essentially, through our platform, we facilitated kind of the loss of communication that we've lost in this Zoom world, versus sitting in a physical office. This concept of everything has to be a meeting and formal, and you don't really learn through osmosis like you would when you're sitting in a physical office. And then, so we built a product. Originally, it was an internal tool, and then COVID, we had such high demand for our telecommunication customers that we released it as a product. So that's called SignalWire Work, and we go into the office, and I can see all my employees all day long. I can see when they're in the office, out of the office. I can pop in and say hi. They can pop in and say hi to me. It's a different analogy of working in this COVID world.
That is so interesting. So I'm always broadcasting, even if I'm just sitting there working. Do people feel comfortable doing that? What if I pick my nose or something like that?
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, candidly, it's prior to COVID, and because we did this prior to COVID, it was something I had to explain when recruiting employees. Like, hey, we use always on video. You're probably not used to it. It's a little weird, but you get used to it. And that's the reality. Like, people really get used to it, and you kind of forget, a little bit, you forget that you're even not in the same room with people when you have always on video all the time, and you're, you speak aloud. It's hard to explain without living it. But then, if you're picking your nose or something, we've got controls for that. So we have a mode where it would kind of frost your video so people can see a silhouette of you, but they really couldn't see you pick your nose. They can just see that you're at your desk.
Right.
Or you can go totally video mute. People will do that. And it's a customizable space. So you can add your own personality or flair like you would in your own office, at your job. Again, put stuff on the wall, your family, your picture of your yard or whatever.
Well, I'm on the website now and it looks really cool. I mean, I see the little demo here and I like the way you have the screen divided up better than some of your competitors. And you give priority to certain things, and it just seems cleaner and, a little crisper. How would I use this for a virtual event?
Yeah, I'll send you you could Google and see some links. We're doing a lot of virtual events. In fact, we initially put out SignalWire Work completely as a remote office alternative. And obviously due to the COVID demand, there's just heavy demand for that type of thing, like some Zoom alternative. And we've been fulfilling that, but like a third of the leads, and this is a surprise to us, a third of the leads that we would get just for that product, and this is without speaking about it on our website or in any ad, are actually for online events, because the online event world is horrible. Like, there's really no, in today's world, in a pre-SignalWire world, there's not a lot of reason to participate in an online event because you don't really experience the whatever is live with an audience. You don't it with other people. There's no social interaction.
My personal record is 3 online events at the same time.
Right. Because you're really not paying attention to any
exactly.
of them.
Exactly. I can do 3 or 4 of them and Christmas shop all at the same time.
Exactly. I mean, it's just not good. And so part of our technology advantage is we can put 100 people on screen at the same time at 20 frames a second with, high definition audio. And we can mux that together where it sounds great. You can actually have 100 people on the screen. And, you know, for example, we put on a concert last week, and, you know, the performer could see and interact with the audience. He could build off the energy of the audience. He could hear their claps. He could hear their song requests, just kind of like if they were in the same room. And, you know, the feedback of the people that attended is like, this was special. You know, I haven't felt like this since, you know, I was at a real event. And that's kind of what we're going for. We're trying to bridge that weird thing that's happening where the online socialization is just unsatisfying. And a lot of that can be solved by just getting people on video and have the quality be good, have the audio be good, and let them talk to each other.
And so as you pivot toward a more consumer-based model, has your revenue followed suit, or is 99% of your revenue still enterprise-based?
Yeah, I mean, these are new products for us, so we're still in the earliest stages. The SignalWire Work product's, I think, about 8 weeks old since we launched it. So obviously, like, a good percentage of our inbound interest is are for those products, but our company is an enterprise infrastructure company foremost. So these are great reference designs that are fully functional applications, and they're great. We hope that it inspires other enterprises and application developers to build similar things with our technology. And so we're excited to see how people innovate with it. But in the meantime, we're selling to businesses because there's just nothing better to get. We're selling a virtual office product and an online events product. And we're working on a broadcasting product. We're actually working with two major television production studios that I have NDAs and cannot name, but they are using for multiple broadcast television shows just because of the audio quality that's supported within the platform.
I hear interviews on television all the time that I'm just shocked that they air, that it's, there's a metallic sound to it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It's compression. And what you're hearing is the result of algorithms trying to trim out as much of the audio to get it down to a size small enough that they can transmit it over the internet. And, you know, we have some of the best tech there. So we can actually do, you know, wideband transmission audio, which is, you know, better than CD audio from within the service. And then we can do up to 4K video. If you have enough bandwidth, you have to have a lot, but we can do 4K video. And like I said, the people that care about quality from the production studios or end up using our platform simply for that reason.
Right. Well, I feel like we'll see it a lot as it replaces that horrible junk that we hear now. Again, I'm shocked the stuff that they put out there, even in like the Emmy Awards and stuff where people are broadcasting from their houses. Now, the connection still, it just sounds horrible to me so much of the time. You said that you're a Sand Yep. Hill company, a Silicon Valley company, Sand Hill Road. I know exactly what that is. For the listeners who don't, that's just the road that runs through the middle of Silicon Valley right there by Stanford. But yeah, you live in the middle of absolute nowhere off the top of the map in Michigan, right?
Yeah, that's right. So prior to COVID, I would split my time between the Bay Area and my home in the Great Lakes. But I left Palo Alto at the end of February when COVID went mainstream in California, and I've been back from my house in the Great Lakes ever since.
So is your company missing out from the water cooler interactions, or does the software that you've developed allow you to have water cooler interactions, or are you desperate to get back to the office so you can have a water cooler conversation?
You know, honestly, I think everyone misses face-to-face contact with other humans. There's just no real replacement for that. And it's just a weird environment now, or it's been too long. And I think people are really, I think that's part of the reason why we're getting regression in the viruses. But the, you know, we try to solve that with technology, and that really is our mission here with this product. It's, this is how we live. This is bread and butter for us. So, you know, I can go on all day about features, but we've built in things that kind of build office camaraderie. Like, for example, there's a feature we call Clippies, which has kind of like a soundboard, a video soundboard of video clips that we've selected from our favorite movies, the staff. And you can play those kind of at the whim, like with no delay. So, you know, someone says something funny and you can play from the office, "That's what she said." Or, you know, Star Wars clips or whatever it is. So, you know, there's a lot of comedian in playing your favorite little 2 second, 3 second movie clip, kind of like a Giphy would be, you know, if you've ever used animated GIFs or GIFs in messaging. This is kind of like the video version. We also have ways to send audio messages and whispers to people when you're in a conference with multiple people, so you can whisper. And we're actually the first company to figure out how to do with tech karaoke. So we can, you know, play a YouTube karaoke video in the conference, and with no delay, a karaoke singer can just read right off that YouTube video, and everyone else hears it in real time with no delay. It sounds like not a big deal, but it's actually a big deal. And try to do that on Zoom.
Right. So am I going to need to upgrade my bandwidth? Am I going to have to get, I don't know. I don't know what if I have now, if I have enterprise level now or not. What is the minimum bandwidth someone would need?
Not really. I mean, our technology adapts to bandwidth. Obviously, the more bandwidth you have, the higher quality you're going to be able to broadcast with. But, you know, if you wanted to broadcast at high definition audio and say 1080p, like an HD television, at 60 frames a second, which is kind of like what you would get in a really nice Netflix broadcast, maybe at 1080. That would require about 3 megabits of upstream bandwidth. So it's not actually that much. The problem we see that most people have isn't so much their internet bandwidth these days. Is it so much as their internal Wi-Fi networks at their houses? So, you know, if your access point is in your basement or, you know, across the room and you're 2,000 square feet and a floor away, you know, you're probably getting a spotty connection, and that's not the best connection to have a high quality real time video and audio conversation with.
Right. Sean, let's pivot the conversation a little bit. Tell us about getting the business started. Where did the original idea come from? Who got together to go get money? How long did that take? Talk to us from an entrepreneurial history perspective.
Yeah, we have a kind of a profile that's, it happens in Silicon Valley. It's kind of a unique business model. We use open source technology. So the first software we put out, it was a community project that started almost 15 years ago. Not for profit, just free open source software and telecommunications. And a number of our software developers, including our CEO, you know, wrote the majority of that code and gave it out to the world for free. And telecommunication companies of the world, you know, everyone from Deutsche Telekom to, you know, Dialpad, who is kind of the cool phone system, these all used that technology to build their product on. And it became the de facto standard for building a video or audio technology product. So the Ring doorbell, for example, I've hung out with the CEO of Ring, who was acquired by Amazon last year. But yeah, the Ring video, the Ring doorbell, is our code, for the video part. So what ended up happening is we had, literally 1 million downloads a day of this free software and, 20,000 active developers in a community that are using our technology to build their company infrastructure and products. And, that puts us in a very powerful position.
As I said, I thought we're going to be reading articles about you and stuff soon. So,
So we were able to convert that open source community into a story about, you know, the next generation of products we're building. And we took that to Sand Hill Road. And like you said, the Sand Hill Road is a street in Palo Alto where, you know, pretty much all the top firms of Silicon Valley have an office. everyone from Sequoia to Andreessen Horowitz to, you know, Mayfield Fund, all the classics all on Sand Hill Road. So when you're raising money, like we do, we raised, I think $14 million Series A, last year. And so when we were doing that, that was an exercise. And, you know, you literally get in the car and you drive down Sand Hill Road and you're, you know, for 3 days, you've got, you know, every hour, or half hour, you're running around from one place to the other. And it's kind of like, you know, you're selling your baby. So you're hyping your company and you're creating buzz around what you're doing and you create competition, for the investment. And, you know, that's what going to Sand Hill Road is all about.
And how much money did y'all raise? How long did it take you?
Well, we raised $14 million in about a month.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. That's very impressive.
Well, to be honest, Silicon Valley money is flying. Money is flying. The funds are large. They're filled. There's a lot of investment activity around COVID forward technologies. You know, you can see in the public Zoom's evaluation going sky high and then taking a little dip when the vaccine came out. So there's a lot of investment interest around the solutions of remote work and whatever this future world is, you know, once we come out of COVID.
All right. If we ever do. I'm getting tired of it, Sean. Well, you know, and even with the vaccine, that doesn't mean until next summer that we get normal at the soonest. So,
yeah, presuming everybody takes it.
Impressed.
I think we've got a couple years of the world not being normal at least, and that's kind of what we're banking on in the technology as we build it. And yeah, hopefully we get over it, and then hopefully. You know, hopefully we can get back to normal someday. But in the meantime, we're going to do our best to bridge the gap, you know, the best we can do to bridge the gap that you're just not getting from FaceTime.
Sean, when you announce that you're going public, will you do it here first, please? Will you make that commitment today?
We have no plans of going. We're a private company and we're focused on growing the company to be the largest we can. And we're competing with really big operations. We compete with Microsoft, just acquired one of our competitors. And like I said, Amazon is kind of in this industry and we're large publicly traded companies like Twilio and Bandwidth are approaching and the Vonage Corporation. So we've got a lot of, you know, we're against some giants and we do have a better mousetrap. And,
giant will acquire you for $6.8 trillion, roughly.
Yeah, there's probably only a couple companies in the world large enough. To be fair, a lot of people are interested in the technology we have and are building.
Well, congratulations on a great job. Well done. How do we follow the company and continue to watch the progress and most importantly, start using the platform for our business?
Yeah. If you go to signalwire.com, that's SignalWire.com. We can give a 30-day eval, for all your listeners. So there's no, you know, if you want to check out any of our stuff, we'll just give it to you for a month to try without, you know, credit cards or payment or whatever. And, we're rapidly improving the product and we're listening to our customers and, we think we've got something exciting. You know, when, Eric Yuan, the CEO of Zoom invested in us, he invested personally in us, very early on. He was like, hey, don't do video. And we just didn't listen to him.
Oh, how ironic. Sean, great stuff. Congratulations. And I can't wait to watch this one play out as it becomes a player. Thanks for being with
us. Yeah, thanks a lot. Stay in touch.
We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million by now.